Group meeting, Saturday, 13th March, 1982.
You may recollect, if you were here in February, that we had a little celebration of the 20th anniversary weekend since we started these groups in 1962. The celebration consisted of a short recital of the history of the groups, the sort of spirit that animates us, and we asked certain questions with regard to what had happened during these 20 years. In a few words, took stock of ourselves. I put the stock-taking in terms of several questions. The first question was quite an important one. Are we, as a result of our efforts here, a little bit quieter? Now, this point about quietness is an extremely important point where the religious life is concerned. And we must always remember that our concern is not merely an intellectualist study of the doctrines and dogmas of religion, nor are we concerned with comparing religions with each other, which is an appalling thing to do. And not only appalling, but thoroughly stupid. You can't compare anything in the realm of transcendence at all. There is no room for comparison there. There is no better, there is no worse. It is absolute, it is transcendent. So comparison is of no value there at all. So we are not concerned with that. We are concerned with the essential value of religion insofar as it makes us, each one of us, a living human being, finite and mortal, live that kind of life by which that which was intended to come out of us as a human species can come to full fruition. In other words, that each individual person could, even to some degree or other, realize the purpose of his existence in this world and play his part in the best way possible for him. That is our concern. And in this coming to fruition as a perfect human being, and remember that the word human means blissful creator. That's what human means, if you derive it from its original Sanskrit roots. And one of the most important part in this process is the realization of that state of inward poise, of equanimity, which is a silent state, a state of perfect peace. All the things that we have in the theistic religions and in some of the non-theistic religions also, ascribed to the Supreme, to God, we talk of the peace of God which passeth understanding. That is one of the important things. Now, all the things that we ascribe to God in reality apply to us, because God, as conceived by man, is a projection out of his own brain. Man projects God and says, that is God, and describes God. What is he describing? He's describing the end point, the perfection of his own ideals, his own vision as regards his own complete and utter fulfillment. That is what man is presenting when he presents ideas about God. Now, the ideas about God have validity only insofar as they emerge out of the living experience of each. Man's own real living experience of godliness in himself. And this is what he is projecting outwards when he talks of a being called God. If you recall Eckhart's tremendous statement, man verily is God, God verily is man. You will see how truly he has said what actually happens to the individual person, the ordinary man in the world, if and when he is able to live the religious life in its fullness. You will find that statement on page 194 of the first volume of the translations by Evans, C.W. Evans, you see, of Eckhart's works. It's in the first volume, page 194. So remember that. And look it up if you feel like it. So now, our concern is just precisely that. Our interest is that. How shall we live in order that that may be realized? And that realization takes place, begins to take place when the individual person is able to enter the silence within himself. So let us just consider a few points in connection with this question which I put. Are we a little bit quieter? Quietness is, of course, essential in the ordinary way, in the ordinary meaning of the word, in our everyday life, for our own good health's sake. If we do not have quietness, we are nerve-wracked, aren't we? And one of the prices we pay for our technological progress and so forth is that we are bombarded with noise night and day nowadays. There are very few of us who escape that. But nevertheless, we must bear in mind that this quietness is essential. How does it help us? Certain essential things come out. If a person is quiet physically and particularly psychically, then there is greater sensitivity. Sensitivity from within grows. Sensitivity to what? Sensitivity to that which is transcendent, relatively to us as we are. And we begin to get into touch with what we commonly call the divine. We are more sensitive to that. In fact, one of the great systems of philosophy in India, the Sankhya system, propounded the idea of subtle senses. If one uses one's sense of sight, of hearing, of touch, and so on, in the right way, if one develops that in the right way, then there is a subtler aspect to all that we see, hear, touch, taste, smell, or think in the ordinary way. There is this greater sensitivity, and there is deeper perception, therefore, of the real nature of that which we experience in life, the real nature of persons, of things, of events, conditions, situations, everything. We have greater and greater perception as to its real nature. And this, of course, helps to enable us to experience at least some peace of mind. Because as we see the real nature of things, if we have any sort of real wisdom, we would cease to grasp at all that is ephemeral, all that is passing. We see that it is not worth anything, really. The things that just come into being proceed and pass away in an endless stream of birth and death, of life and death, as we call it, you see. They are of very little value. What is of real value is the change which takes place in our mode of awareness of existence. And therefore our evaluation, our criteria, they all undergo transformation in consequence. This is very, very important indeed, because we know only too well that the world as a whole makes a mad pursuit after all the unworthy things. They are useless, they are unworthy, they are harmful in fact. They are harmful to us as individual beings, they are harmful to nations, to societies, to international relationships, and so on. So all that can undergo change only if we, the individuals composing the world population, will undergo change. We have the power to transform ourselves. We have no power over the laws of nature and great natural things. If there are volcanoes erupting, earthquakes taking place, if tidal waves come across a country, one can't do anything about it. That's that. If lightning strikes me on my head, well, it is the lightning which will have flashed and survive me. So it is like that. We can't do anything about that. What we can do something about is with respect to ourselves. We are the most flexible, the most amenable factor in the world situation. And it is our bounden duty as human beings, our duty to ourselves and our duty to the creative powers that have brought us into being, natural and spiritual. All these powers, our duty to do the best that we can to change ourselves along the right lines. That is important. I might as well say, what do we mean by the right lines? All the world is self-oriented, self-centered. All the world, as the Buddha put it, is burning with the fires of greed, of hate, and of delusion. Violence, stupidity, fear, all these things play their part. Now, as long as these things play their part, all our institutions, all our interrelationships, personally, in the family, in society, and internationally, they will all necessarily go wrong, because all these elements, fear, violence, and so on, they are all destructive elements. So that is what we really have to deal with, not the external manifestation in terms of the event, but the internal power which produces those things, namely ourselves. My greed, my hate, my fear, my violence, my stupidity is responsible for disaster in my life and in the life of the nation and the life of the world. This is most important. So now, if we have a certain quietness and can see the true nature of things, we will know how to proceed. There will be some sort of peace of mind, less psychical turmoil, and therefore much less of neuroses and psychoses. Now, the culminating point of this sort of development, of course, is in all the great religions of the world, and particularly in the writings of the mystics, has been referred to as the silence, the supreme silence. It has grades, it has stages of development. And the purpose and the fundamental objective of contemplative prayer, or if you like to use the other word, meditation, which we use in the East, samadhi, the state of complete communion with the total reality. That is the meaning of samadhi, the supreme togetherness of the particular with the universal. That is samadhi. In order to realize that state, which is the end point, there are the grades of entry into the silence. Now, how does this silence work? First of all, when we are quiet, we begin to have some sense of the purpose of our existence. It is in the quiet. For instance, if you go out into the woods, into any place which is beautiful, and you are quiet and watchful, you will find yourself experiencing the relationship, the oneness, in the very real sense, in the real sense of a complete union, a unity with the trees, the meadows, the flowers, the birds, everything. You will begin to experience that, you see. And in that experiencing is just the shadow of a touch of the real silence, just the very beginning. As that progresses in other situations too, in troublesome situations particularly, and so forth, then there comes the point when you are only watchful of the situation, peacefully watchful, and in that peaceful watchfulness you know the situation for what it is, and within yourself you are really silent. Whatever our situation is, what does the brain do? It's always talking back at what is actually present. Now, as you are sitting there, for instance, assuming you haven't already fallen asleep, you see, your brain, whilst trying to take in what I'm saying, is also chattering back at me, agreeing, disagreeing, approving, disapproving, etc., etc., etc. You're never quiet. I am not quiet when other people talk to me. My brain is doing just that at the same time, you see, talking back in terms of agreement, disagreement, and so on. You see, criticism, condemnation, approval, blind faith, and all the rest of it, you see. So this psychical turmoil goes on. This psychical turmoil begins to come to rest. And when it comes to rest, you will find a very extraordinary phenomenon taking place. The complete cessation of all discursive thought. Now all the world says that, oh, talking is this, thinking is something different. This is where the world makes its great mistake. What the world calls thinking is merely silent chatter. And if one takes the trouble to look carefully at that chatter, one will see how stupid, how mischievous, how malicious, how absurd, how uninteresting and unuseful the whole chatter is. It's just a turmoil which expresses all our subhuman defects. Only rarely is there a process of thinking which is constructive, which is perhaps even creative, which is a power which benefits our own health and well-being, and is a power which promotes the well-being and good of our own society and the world in general. Only very rarely. This is what we call thinking. But the essential point is that all thinking is just a stream of words. And the stream of words as words, although it could be, it could give a stimulus, it could give an impetus to action, is in itself, this stream of words is just impotent. It really is impotent. Consider, by contrast, how in the scriptures of the world it is said how the thought in the mind of the divine brought forth the universe and brought forth man. Now, when we read things like that, or as in Genesis, and Elohim said, "Let us create man in our own living likeness." You see? Now, that thinking has no relationship whatsoever with what we call thinking. It's not an impotent stream of words. And in any case, the divine has no particular language, even English, wonderful as the English language is. You see? So, there we are. What does all that mean? Mind is a creative power. It's a formative, order-producing power. It is the power that releases cosmos out of chaos. Remember that. If we said, "And God minded, and there was," then the whole situation becomes totally different. And what do we ascribe to the idea of God? Blissfulness, creativeness, utter peace. The silence, the peace that passes all understanding. Which means that there is no discursive thinking process. The whole discursive thinking process, with very rare exceptions, extremely rare exceptions, is almost entirely self-oriented and self-concerned. You will always find that the letter I crops up three or four times at least in any one long sentence. It's always about me and I. You see? This selfness, this ingrained selfness, which is the real meaning of the state of ignorance in the spiritual sense, is something which we have to understand and transform into unselfness. We have to allow it to become transformed. We can't produce the transformation by will. You can stop the discursive thought process by certain meditative techniques and all the rest of it. But that's all utterly useless. That is like the use of tranquilizers or drugs or dope or of some sort or other to bring about a personally desired result. You have read, you have been told by people whom you call the teacher or the Holy One or whoever it is, that if you stop the discursive thought process, then you will make your first entry into the realm of the transcendent. And because we are greedy for the transcendent, the greed for God is not much different from the greed for having two bottles of whiskey a day. You see, not much different. There was a slight difference, but not very much. You see, so that sort of religious practice is the result of our greed, and it is self-oriented and self-concerned. Look into this very carefully. Do look into this very, very carefully, because if you really see the truth of this sort of thing, then you will find that so much of one's own inner trouble, difficulty, misery, ill health, psychical ill health particularly, it'll all just drop off by itself. You see? You don't have to drive the devil out. Let him depart in peace. And he'll leave you alone. Perhaps he will do something better than leaving you alone. He will use his powers, and the devil has tremendous power. Every demon in our own psyche has tremendous power to give you energy for truly constructive, creative work in life. A vice which is allowed to transform naturally and spontaneously into a virtue gives tremendous power for good to the individual. So remember that. Now, what is the significance then of this cessation of discursive thought?
in terms of one's own consciousness, of one's own mode of awareness of existence in general, and of his own place in existence in particular. What is the significance of the cessation of the discursive thought process? This discursive thought process is, as we already see, just a string of words all the time. What do words represent? Our nouns and verbs represent things and objects and persons and relationships between them in action are denoted by the verbs in the language. Adjectives, adverbs and all the rest of it qualify the nouns and the verbs and so on, you see. They are the words, the verbs are the relation makers. The nouns are the things and the persons, the actual material reality with which we deal. Now, if you take the trouble to watch your own thought process for even 5 or 6 minutes, you will find that your consciousness is completely confined to this worldly realm of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal. Something comes up in consciousness, and you associate the I am I with that which comes up in consciousness. That's why we say, I think. Otherwise we wouldn't say it. You see? I think simply means that I have been born in this particular situation, this particular moment, in this thought or feeling or whatever it is. Then it proceeds and it comes to its end, natural end. Something else immediately rises up, and the I am I associates itself with that. And that is the real meaning of rebirth. There is no other rebirth. There is ample evidence to show that that this and this specifically is the real meaning of rebirth. All right. So now the word deals with the finite, the temporal, the mortal. And we are conscious of this world only in terms of the perishing, in terms of birth and death, of finitude and mortality, all the time. It is this consciousness which has to undergo complete transformation into a totally different mode of awareness of the totality. And in that transformation, the real meanings of immortality and the fulfillment of the purpose of our existence will emerge. This is where the silence, as we call it, comes in. What actually happens? Look at a thought process. As I have already said, one thought process ends and is immediately replaced by another one. And so we go on in that manner. So there is a birth, death, rebirth, re-death, rebirth, re-death in endless succession during our single lifetime. All right. Now, our idea of death is involved in this experiencing of the death now and the rebirth in the next thought or the next event or action or whatever it is. Our idea of death is conditioned by the fact that we see an actual dead body. And seeing an actual dead body, when we kill a mosquito or an ant or something like that, oh, that's finished with. It's annihilated. The sense of annihilation is deeply involved with our idea of death. And so we think of our own death as an annihilation. You see, this idea of annihilation. So there is a gap between what we call death and what we like to call rebirth. There is a gap there. But now, there is that gap because we are unable to follow in consciousness in a continuous stream the whole life process. There is only actually eternal life. Actually, there is only eternal life, beginningless, endless, you see. But we are unable to be in tune with that from split second to split second. We are unable to be in tune with that. But if we practice proper watchfulness, you know how Jesus said, watch and pray. And the Buddha said, samasati and samasamadhi. Perfect mindfulness, which means perfect awareness, which means therefore also perfect observation of what is happening, from split second to split second, you will find that there will be no break in consciousness whatsoever. You see? And with no break in consciousness, the flow of discursive thought, which imprisons consciousness in particular forms, desires, urges, and so on, is finished with. You have finished with death. And your mode of awareness of existence has undergone a complete transformation. And this is the state of this inner silence. Because whilst you are entirely in tune with the whole cosmic process, in ultimate realization, but in the early stages of personal realization, you'll be completely in harmony with the whole life process in your own psychophysical organism. And that is the real experience of immortality. There is no death consciousness and the gap interfering with this continuous flow of the life, of the living consciousness. You see? This is the tremendous significance of the silence. But do we ever observe silence? When do we observe silence? Think. Try and recall the silent moments of life, the magical moments of life. In the real silent moments, you are in complete union with the immediate situation. Whether that immediate situation be a person, your wife or your husband, or whether the immediate situation be anything whatsoever, you are in complete union with it. And in that state of complete union, there is no ordinary type of brain consciousness which says, I know this is the silence. What is true realization, true fulfillment, is not known by the brain in the manner in which the brain knows things. That is, in terms of a verbal statement, this, that, and the other. You see, this is the extraordinary thing. That silence takes you into a peace and a state of unity with the world in which you live, which utterly defies all expression or description. But it is the blissful state. Now this can be realized without consciousness going to sleep, without becoming unconscious. When you and I, as ordinary mortals, at least I am an ordinary mortal, I don't know about all of you, but when I, an ordinary mortal, go to sleep, that state of complete unity with the cosmos is realized in profound slumber only, not in the dream part of slumber, not in the dream state, but in the dreamless, completely slumbering state. then there is no imposition upon the world by me, the separate individual. When I dream, I'm still imposing myself as the separate individual upon my situation. And of course, in the daily life, the big I am struts about all over the world, you know, the great conquering hero and all the rest of that nonsense. So you see, the significance of quietness, of silence. This is why the silence is so important, and it will just emerge by itself. In Buddhist teaching, what is called the second jhana is the first entry into this state of silence. It is the very first touch of the immortal in our ordinary, everyday waking state. It is the first touch of it only. Because that state doesn't last very long. It lasts just a few moments at best. And as one grows in that silence, then it lasts as long as you want it to last. You can enter that state as you will, when you will, and for as long as you will. Now, this teaching in Buddhism is contrary to what the great Christian mystics like St. Teresa have said. Not only St. Teresa, but several other of the great Christian mystics. They say that it is just the grace of God which gives it to you as a gift, and it lasts only a fraction of a second and you're out again. That is not the case. You can deliberately enter it. You deliberately enter it not as a positive I am act of entering the state, breaking down a door and entering the state. It's not that. It is a state of grace insofar as the self-oriented self-consciousness no longer attempts to grasp that state. You allow that state to enter into you and take you up. It is transcendence which does all the work and which realizes itself through you. Let this happen, and not only you, but the whole world will be different. If the light of transcendence shines in and through any one person at any time, that light lightens the load and misery and darkness of the whole world. This is something we don't quite understand, because this is how things function transcendentally through consciousness. Consciousness is something which we don't really know. The philosophers and the psychologists have talked a whole heap of nonsense about the nature of consciousness. Actually, consciousness is identical with the primordial creative energy which brought the cosmos into being. Consciousness is that, but it has in its flowering a different kind of manifestation from the kind of manifestation of creative energy which releases the objective universe as such. Besides the objective universe, there is this subjective state, this subjective universe, which is tied up with consciousness, you see. And so actually consciousness and the primordial creative energy are a unity. Now, realize this sort of thing and you will find that the whole world changes. Not because you want to change it, but because you, the individual, have seen into the state of selfness which prevails, and seeing it with a complete clarity releases you from bondage to selfness, and the unselfed state comes into being, the pure state. The state of the newborn infant. Of such is the kingdom of heaven.